Greetings, greetings once again to all my enemies and all my friends. Well, you may have heard the news, but stand by now for the worldview. That's right, it is the Weekly Worldview, and I'm your host, Doug McBurney. Welcome back. It's the show where we don't take calls. We don't tolerate sponsors, but we do help focus you on the events of the week through the lens of original thought. It's good to have everybody back here as we are working here at the McBurney compound to solve our yearly irrigation problem. I think we've solved it. I think we've solved the irrigation problem once again this year, and now life can return to normal, meaning we're just afraid of hail and tornadoes for the next month or so. Hail or tornadoes, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, at least they're not like earthquakes, right? Earthquakes. The thing about earthquakes is they kind of, earthquakes affect everybody in the area. A hail or a tornado, it might just throw your house into the next state. Or it might just pummel only your bushes and shred all the leaves off of only your shrubbery, while your neighbor's shrubbery goes relatively unscathed. So I think I prefer earthquakes. I really don't like either one. Hey, what are the odds? What are the odds that on a 4.543 billion year old planet that we would be alive in the little sliver of time where there are two earthquakes in 2 days? What are the odds of that? Astonishingly slim is what they are. Now, I looked this up. Back in 1968, the age of the Earth was estimated at 2.96 billion years. And when I wrote my note here on my scratch paper, as I was trying to write down witty and funny and educational and enlightening things that I like to bring to you on the show, I took a stab at 4.35 billion was what came off the top of my head. And then I jumped on the internet to research, and I cross-referenced three different sources that placed the age of the Earth at 4.543 billion years. Not 4.5, not 4.54, but 4.543 billion years old. So what are the odds that on a planet that old, there would be two earthquakes in 2 days? And number two, that we humans, who are just an accident of evolution, would happen to be alive during the sliver of time when those two earthquakes occurred. I think it's highly unlikely, which is why it's a small world, and it's not very old either. I know, I stole that line from Bob Enyar, but it's a good line, so, you know. We license each other's material. We have a free licensing agreement, is what we have, so... I don't believe the Earth is any older than about 10,000 years, and that's why things are so shaky out there. Why are things so particularly shaky in the Ring of Fire? Why is that? Why is it that earthquakes occur primarily in that ring around the Pacific? Well, there's an explanation for it, and the foundations of that explanation can be found in the book of Genesis, believe it or not. I mean, if you're willing to be reasonable and rational, and you don't want to buy into fantasies about a 4.5 billion year old planet that's still shaking and rumbling and crumbling and falling in on itself. So, all right, so we are grateful, well, not to anyone in particular, but we're just grateful that the earthquakes are happening now, because we may find ourselves in the Southern California area sometime in the not too distant future, and we would prefer that everything is nice and settled down before we go visit, that's all. All right. Let's see here. We've got the Women's World Cup. The Women's World Cup, big news. You know what the big news about the Women's World Cup is? Is all the big news made about the Women's World Cup. Because nobody cares about the Women's World Cup. Nobody watches the Women's World Cup except the players' moms and their stepdads and their dads with their stepmothers. Yeah, that's who watches the Women's World Cup. It's a bunch of lesbians and liberals out there playing a game that I will admit that the game is appropriate for girls. So I'm not going to argue with the appropriateness of there being a Women's World Cup. I kind of chuckle at the men's World Cup, a bunch of men out there playing a girls' game. But there was a chant, apparently, at the end of the Women's World Cup final, which was today, I think. Could have been yesterday, as the American women manhandled the Dutch.
What's that mean?
Manhandled them. That means they beat them handily. I guess I shouldn't say manhandled, but I think I could say manhandled. Yes, I think that's appropriate, as a matter of fact. But they broke out in a chant of equal pay, equal pay, equal pay. Because apparently the women's World Cuppers, if that's what you call them, they don't get paid as much as the boys. And now that could be because they don't generate 1/100th of the revenue that the boys generate. That's a possibility that it could have something to do with that. But it could just be because of our patriarchal, anti-feminist society, a civilization built on the oppression of women. That could be the reason, or it could be the fact that nobody watches except your mom. So why should we pay you a lot of money if nobody's going to watch except your mom? I mean, she can only buy one Buick. So how many commercials? Get out of here with that equal pay. All right. Women's World Cup, please. All right. So that takes care of that. Let's see here. What do I want to do? I'll talk about Betsy Ross maybe later. First, I want to talk a little bit about Lee Iacocca, who passed away this past week. And a story I read about him that I found to be emblematic of just truth and reality and the way the world really works. Okay? So, back in the late 1970s, you'll remember that the communist liberal parasites in the government under the tutelage of Jimmy Carter and Richard Nixon, by the way, and Gerry Ford, they all colluded to institute fuel economy regulations and safety regulations on cars that made it virtually impossible for Detroit to continue churning out the giant steel land cruisers. They look like submarines with wheels. The 1970s Oldsmobile, right? Remember those? Giant, tubular, massive, weighed about 3 tons. Fantastic cars. My first car was a 1972 Oldsmobile Delta 88 with a 455 rocket engine in it. I feel like 1,000 horsepower. Anyway, just a giant lumbering death trap. And we could easily get that thing from 0 to 120, well, a lot faster than we should have. Let's just leave it at that. That car was fast. Ugly, hideous-looking car. Hideous. So I remember cruising down Main Street there looking to see if the girls were looking. And they were looking all right, and they were, man, what is that hideous brown thing? Anyway. But that's back when cars were big and heavy and made of steel, right? So the guilt-ridden liberals at the top of the government, they all colluded to make the big cars go away, right? You remember that. Stringent fuel economy regulations, right? Imposed by the communists under Jimmy Carter. Well, they made it difficult. The station wagon was over with, right? So, Lee Iacocca started reading through the rules written by these morons in the government. And he realized, one thing he realized was that people still wanted something like a station wagon. They wanted something they could put all their kids in and all their stuff in and go off for the weekend. He knew they wanted that. So he read the rules and he realized that the geniuses in the government had a separate category for something called a light truck. A light truck was considered back then to be a utility van that, you know, the plumber would have. Or an electrician would drive around with one of these light trucks, right? And so what did Lee Iacocca do? He decked out a light truck and he put seats in it and he left room in the back and he called it a minivan. And he got around the rules on fuel economy because the government classified it as a light truck. And so Mr. Lee Iacocca created one of the most successful designs in the history of design, especially in automobile design, because he was just trying to outsmart the bureaucrats who were trying to restrict his business. And he did it. And so now we all know and love the minivan, although I'm not a big fan. If I'm going to have something big, I just want a great big old SUV. And if you need as much room as a minivan, then you just get a really, really great big SUV. That's what I like. Just get one that's big like a minivan, but that doesn't look as dumb. I shouldn't say that. I know you people love your minivans. I'm sorry. I don't want to offend anyone. But I think this is one of those things where we can agree to disagree, and we don't have to be mad at each other. Anyway, Lee Iacocca is an example of why some people work in the government and then other smarter people, other people with more wisdom, more smarts, and more ambition, they work in private industry. And so many of us in private industry spend a vast quantity of our time just trying to get around the rules written to regulate us by people who don't really know what we do. And so Lee Iacocca was a symbol of that. And we thank Mr. Iacocca for coming up with the minivan. And you know, the interesting thing about Lee Iacocca is that he's the father of the Mustang, right? He's the father of the minivan. He pulled Chrysler out of bankruptcy, talked the government into a massive loan, and then paid that loan back with interest. And just a legendary persona here while he dwelt upon the earth. But the other day when he passed on to the other side, the only thing that mattered was whether or not Jesus Christ was his friend or his enemy. That's the only question that really mattered about Lee Iacocca in that moment in time. The Mustang, you know, if Jesus turned out to be Lee Iacocca's advocate, they would get to the Mustang later. But if Jesus Christ turned out not to be Lee Iacocca's advocate, then the minivan and the Mustang would never even come up. It wouldn't even matter. What would matter is what was the decision that Lee Iacocca made regarding his relationship to the creator of the universe, the judge and the savior of all the earth. So we'll find out when we get to the other side. I hope we get to see Lee. So I'd like to talk with him about some stuff. All right. Meanwhile, so I just talked about, you know, some people work for the government. They're generally dim-witted, generally speaking. And other people work for private industry and they're generally smarter. But that's only a rule of thumb and it doesn't apply universally, as we can see by the executive brain trust over at Starbucks. So it seems Starbucks has a problem with junkies. So for whatever reason, Starbucks attracts junkies. I'm not sure. Are heroin addicts particular? Are they coffee connoisseurs? I don't really know what the attraction is with Starbucks and junkies. But apparently, the employees up there in the Seattle area, they began getting concerned over the dangerous working conditions that they would find with all the hypodermic needles in the bathroom, on the floor, in the trash cans, because of all the junkies. And so I don't know if these are like, maybe these are middle class working junkies who they like slide off their sport coat and then shoot up and then go to work. I don't know if that exists. I don't think so. I think the problem here is that Starbucks allows the dregs of the planet to leave their shopping cart outside and then come in and use the bathroom. The brain trust at Starbucks has a solution for the problem. They're going to put sharps containers, needle disposal boxes, in the bathrooms so that if you're having coffee and you decide, gee, I'd like to follow that up with some heroin, you could go in the bathroom and shoot up and then you can throw your dirty needle in the sharps container, and everybody's safe, and all is well and good in the world. This is filed this week in the Liberal Solutions file. That's where it came to us from. That's the liberal solution. Don't tell the junkie he's not welcome and that he should clean up his act before he dies in the street like a dog. Don't give the junkie some advice, even if it's harsh, tough love, that might turn the junkie around and save his life. No, let's tolerate the junkie. Let's help the junkie shoot up in the bathroom. And then let's all go on Facebook and tell each other what great people we are. And I'm your host, Doug McBurney. Welcome back. For all we know, he could have been singing about heroin or quitting heroin.
Huh?
He could have been indecipherable. But I just like the Hammond B3 on that one. I can't. So meanwhile, folks, as the brain trust at Starbucks put Sharps containers in the bathroom to further condemn more junkies to die. Is what they do. Meanwhile, over at the Denver Department of Public Safety, there's a director there. His name is Tony Riggs. He's the director of the Denver Department of Public Safety. No doubt some high-ranking governing official's dim-witted nephew, given this job of director of public safety. He is suggesting that the student council there in Denver take a look at the idea of asking police and firemen to carry canned food in their vehicles. Canned beans, canned corn, tuna fish, maybe those little sardines in the mustard sauce, maybe. Why? Well, so that if they come across, let's say, a criminal or a junkie, and they realize that said criminal or junkie or guy beating his girlfriend up or someone screaming at someone else through the window at 3 o'clock in the morning, just whoever the police come across, they may realize in an ancillary fashion that that person or a person associated with the situation could be struggling with food insecurity. And if the police officer happens to have a can of beans in the trunk of his car, he could help alleviate the food insecurity of that particular citizen. Yes, I have a quote here from Troy Riggs, the director of the Denver Department of Public Safety. He actually said this on camera in front of God and everybody. He said, quote, "How can you succeed if you're hungry," unquote.
Well, he's smart.
To which I said, so this guy is missing the whole point of hunger. I don't think Mr. Riggs understands that hunger makes the world go round. Hunger is the foundation of our economic system. Hunger, yes, it's the foundation of everything. And it spurs achievement in normal people. And by normal people, I just mean normal, God-fearing American people. We wake up in the morning, we're hungry. So we go and we get some food, which that means a farmer is growing the food and the person who trucks it to the store and the slaughterhouse, you know, the processing center. Hunger makes the whole world go around, Mr. Riggs. But you're such a dim-witted moron, you're a mid-level, shiftless, slack-jawed government idiot who thinks that police handing out a can of beans to a junkie who threw a wrench through a window at 3 o'clock in the morning is going to somehow solve the world's problems. Troy, you're a moron. So you're basically robbing the hungry of their motivation. Now, I will tell you a story. At one time in my career, I was not very successful. I found myself living without a home. Well, I had a home, but it was just a very small Japanese car is what it was. That was my home. And so I remember that at this particular low point in my career, that I and my extremely attractive audio engineer. That was our home. That's right. It had three seats, two bucket seats and a back seat. It's pretty luxurious. Well, anyway, we got hungry one time, right? So we went down to the, I don't know what they called it, a soup kitchen or a food pantry. I don't know. One of these things where losers go to get food because they're losers. And so we stood in line for far longer than I was willing to stand in line. And I decided at that point that I would rather work than go to the food pantry or the soup kitchen. And look, I just looked around at all these people and I'm thinking, do I really fit in with this crowd? Because if that's the case, I need to back up and I need to reassess. I may need to make some changes in my life. And so anyway, after that, I got a job and I went to work. And the rest is history, as they say. But Troy Riggs here, just a genius. How can you succeed if you're hungry? Mr. Riggs, you can't succeed if you're not hungry, okay? But I'll bet you Troy Riggs has never missed a meal. I'll bet this guy's been slopping it up at the government trough since he got out of college, where he somehow flim-flammed his way to a C average. All right. Just get out of here with that. Okay. So let's go now to, let's go to prison, okay? Or jail, I should say. I've got a story from the Charlotte, South Carolina News Observer where they report that a woman has been planting drugs at the rest area on the side of the highway. She's been planting drugs there as part of a scheme. So why, you ask, would a woman be hiding drugs at a rest area? Well, that's because inmates from the McDougal Correctional Institution work on a litter crew cleaning up the side of the road, and they just happen to amble by that particular rest area on a regular basis. And it turns out she was leaving drugs, tobacco, and other contraband in the rest area, and they were being picked up by inmates and then smuggled into the prison, believe it or not. So you can tell that these prisoners, these are not government workers. These are fairly sophisticated people. So I guess the South Carolina Department of Corrections started recording phone calls between the woman and a particular inmate, and that tipped them off as to what was going on. And I'm sure it took the prison officials quite some time to put two and two together, but they finally figured it out. They put it together, an inmate labor crew. They picks up trash along the interstate. Supposedly, they're under the supervision of correctional officers. And the idea of this woman running a scheme with prisoners to smuggle drugs into the prison, that was highly offensive to the correctional officers because they typically smuggle in the drugs to the prison. And so they don't really want any competition. All right. So I believe that a prison jail is a bad idea. It leads to stuff like this where the criminals end up outsmarting and running the institution. Or they sit there and they fester and they just get mad and they hate the world, justifiably, because prison is not a justifiable punishment. There are better alternatives to than locking a man up like a dog, okay? And then he gets drugs in prison too. So the bad idea. The whole prison thing is a bad idea. Now, speaking of bad ideas, let's go to the bad religion file, where we go to Father Bill de Blasio, who is high priest. He is a high priest, I do believe, in the Church of the Poison Mind. Wasn't that a song from the 80s? Church of the Poison Mind? Well, if not, I'm going to coin that term, or I'm just going to steal it from whoever put it in that song. Bill de Blasio, high priest of the Church of the Poison Mind, has called for universal 3K education. I scratched my head when I read that, and I'm like, what is 3K education? 3K to me sounds like 3,000. So what? What does that mean? Well, what it means is he wants your three-year-old. Yeah, he wants to put your three-year-old in something like kindergarten that they call 3K. And he says that this idea of snatching your children at the age of three for full-day education of three-year-olds is what he wants. And he's a communist. He's a child-killing communist, homosexualist, pervert, creep, and he wants your three-year-old. And you know what's amazing? Is that people fall all over themselves to hand the three-year-olds off to these commie pervert bastards. Here in Denver, the pervert mayor in Denver, that slimy pervert scum, announced that they were going to do, not just the mayor in Denver either, that cretin pervert faggot governor of ours signed a bill saying that you could bring, I think, kindergarten for everybody starting at, I don't know, 4 years old. Kindergarten for all. And they estimated X number of people would sign up. And it turns out way more people signed up. So parents literally cannot wait to hand their children off to demented, diabolical, evil people. They just can't wait. So they can binge watch Netflix. I don't know what the hell is going on with these people's minds. Anyway, Denver can't figure out how to pay for the kindergarten for all the people, for all the slack-jawed, idiotic parents who want to hand their kids off to the perverts and the molesters at the government schools. And now Bill de Blasio, he's doing it in New York, and he can't even keep up with the demand. He can't even keep up with the demand of the parents that their children be psychologically, spiritually, and in many cases, physically molested in the public schools. The demand for that is through the roof. I cannot understand people. I cannot relate to people who are into this, who fall for this. I don't believe you can be stupid enough or ignorant enough or just not paying attention enough. No, maybe you can be. Maybe that's it. I shouldn't be so cynical. These parents are basically decent people who just aren't really paying attention. That's probably what it is. They have no idea. What is it? They're just falling through time and space in between. I don't know what's going on with these people. Anyway, 20,000 three-year-olds in New York will be getting universal 3K this fall. Now, and de Blasio predicts that 500,000 jobs will be created in the educational gulag system that he's building there. He foresees his gulag going out across the whole country, employing another 500,000 so-called educators. And he wants, if he's elected president, which is highly unlikely, Mr. de Blasio, just so you know. So we can all breathe a sigh of relief knowing that Bill de Blasio will never be the president. You know why? Just because he's so unpleasant to listen to and to look at. Besides his policies are catastrophic. But he's just a really annoying person to anyone outside of New York. There's no way. Bill, that doesn't play outside of New York. I'm sorry. Let's see here. Bill says in New York, when it comes to 3K education, I'm not just talking the talk. I'm walking the walk. So here's a guy who, he's evil to his core, a communist sympathizer from his youth, somehow becomes elected the mayor of one of the biggest metropolitan cities in the world, and he's bamboozling people into handing him their children at the age of 3 years old. Shocking. So this has to be a religion, at least for de Blasio. You know, I think religions are generally really, really important to the people who make their living off the religion. And then most of the people in the pews, they're just going along and they're not really paying that much attention. And I think that Bill de Blasio's Church of the Poison Mind, as instigated there in New York, is an example of not really just a bad religion, but just a typical religion. It's really, really important to Bill because he's pocketing a lot of money and feathering his nest for a fine and comfortable retirement. And the people sitting in the pews, well, I'm sorry. You might want to claim that you just weren't paying attention, or you were too busy, or mom had to work so we could get the second BMW, or I was binge watching. You can claim whatever you want, but you are going to be held responsible for the responsibility that God gave you with your kids. And if you handed them over to perverts and creeps like Bill de Blasio and who's that creep in Denver? I can't even remember his name. The governor of Denver? No, the governor of Colorado, I mean. I don't even want to know his name. I don't want to speak his filthy name on my lips. Just don't hand your kids over to these people.
Floors, they get the spaces in between. I wanna live a life like that. I wanna be just like a king. Take my picture by the pool, 'cause I'm the next big thing in Beverly Hills. That's where I want to be.
I'm your host, Doug McBurney. Welcome back. Welcome back. I'm having a little trouble with my just engaging my brain housing group with my voice and mouth for some reason today. I don't know what's going on. So you have to bear with me, okay? This is we do this show in one take. There's no practice. I mean, this is it. It's one shot. It goes out. Now we bounce off the Bad Religion file. We come from the Church of the Poison Mind to the Church of the Fake and Fairly Dumb, another story from the Bad Religion file, as Donald Trump bamboozled gullible evangelicals this past week out at the Fake and Fairly Dumb convention, otherwise known on Fox News as the Faith and Freedom Convention, but known here on the Weekly Worldview as the Fake and Fairly Dumb Convention. It used to be the Faith and Freedom Coalition, you see. But now it's the Faith and Freedom Convention, but the fake and fairly dumb part has not changed. It is still the same. All of the gullible evangelicals running the coalition or the convention, whatever they want to call it, they're all fake and fairly dumb. And Trump spoke to them, and they were, they were impressed. That's what they were. Trump has said he was very optimistic that he could win re-election because of all the energy in the room. And the evangelicals went wild. Uh-huh. Yeah, they all went wild. Cheering, whistling. Anyway, and then now for the third time, or is this the fourth time maybe? I'm keeping count. Donald Trump made this statement, quote, "Every child born and unborn is made in the holy image of God. And that is why I have asked Congress to prohibit the late-term abortion of babies," Trump said, not realizing the disjointed disconnect right in the very statement right there. He should have said prohibiting the killing of babies or just prohibiting the abortion of babies. But no, he didn't. He had to slip the late term in there. Why? Because Donald Trump is okay with killing some babies, as are most of the pro-life movement these days. They're okay with the killing of some, as long as you make them feel like they have a sense that some are not being killed because of them and the donations they made to organizations like the Fake and Fairly Dumb Coalition. It's just a shame, Mr. Trump. So whenever you invoke the name of God over your child-killing policies, Mr. President, you need to keep in mind that God is actually listening, and you are going to make him very, very angry with you, Mr. Trump. And he is going to rain down hellfire and damnation on your head forever. and you are going to suffer eternally, Mr. President. God hates your guts when you say that. And he's going to get even with you, Mr. President. And I know you like to tell Kim Jong-un that we have bigger missiles. Well, God's got the big guns, Mr. Trump. So you need to repent of this, and you need to apologize for using the name of God over your damnable child-killing policy, Mr. President. You need to repent. I'm not gonna act like the bozos at the fake and fairly dumb convention and tell you you're great and that God loves you and that God anointed you to be president and all that hogwash is what it is. You're a fairly smart guy who lucked into a real estate fortune through smarts, a combination of smarts and the ability to bribe governing officials. And you're not that impressive to God. Even $1 billion doesn't impress God. I heard he's got an asteroid flying around that's got like $800 trillion on it. And that's just like, that's the spare change in God's ashtray, Mr. Trump. So you're not going to impress him when you meet him. In fact, you're going to fall down on your face terrified because of what you said, Mr. President. All right, let's leave that aside. Now, we'll go from that. Now, I just warned Donald Trump that he's going to meet God, and God is going to judge him severely, eternally, if he doesn't get his act together and apologize. And so now we go to evidence that Jesus Christ, the Son of the living God, indeed walked the face of the earth. The City of David Foundation has unveiled a 2,000-year-old main thoroughfare from Roman-era Jerusalem to the ancient Jewish... It's a road from the ancient Jewish temple from the Pool of Siloam, built by King Hezekiah. Yeah, they found the road that was mentioned in the Bible. It was hidden under a potato field, and it was discovered by accident in 2004 when a sewer pipe broke. It had to be fixed. So I've got a quote here from a spokesman for the City of David Foundation. He says, from a sewage pipe that burst 15 years ago came excavations that resulted in the discovery of the Pool of Siloam. So the Pool of Siloam, by the way, is mentioned, I believe, more than once in the New Testament. And the Pool of Siloam, according to the City of David Foundation, is where all the Jewish pilgrims would come and cleanse themselves before ascending to the temple. And they found not only the Pool of Siloam, they found an entire road. He said, not a relic, not an antiquity, but an entire road intact from the pool ascending to the temple. And the whole world is irate that the Jews have uncovered the Pool of Siloam and the road. They hate it. Why? Because it reminds them that Jesus Christ is real. That the God of the Bible, the God of the scriptures, is the living God. And they just absolutely hate that. And you know what's interesting? Is that living God, who's all-powerful, he's got an $80 trillion asteroid just floating around in space. He has all the power in the whole universe. And as much as those people hate him, he was still willing to give his life to give them an opportunity to live. He was still willing, as much as they hate him, is as much as he was willing to do for them. While they yet hated him, he actually laid down his life to give them the opportunity to live. Amazing. Amazing. All right, now, we go from the bad religion file. No, that was not the bad religion file. That was the Bible is so obviously true file. It's just so obviously true. So many things in the Bible that are mentioned just in passing. You know, that we find it 2,000, 3,000, 3,500 years later. We find it buried in the dirt. Pretty incredible. But from there, we go to reason number 1,198 to get or keep your kids out of the government schools, as if we needed another reason, but we have one. And it comes from the Ohio. That's right. Ohio has removed the Ten Commandments plaque. From a middle school there. Uh-huh. Let's see. The Wisconsin-based group Freedom From Religion Foundation. We've heard that. They rear their ugly heads quite often. Anytime there's anything good or wholesome that kids are allowed to look at, the Freedom From Religion Foundation gets upset. And they send a pile of child molesting lawyers to stop whatever it is that's good and wholesome and righteous that's being done. In this case, it was children gazing upon the Ten Commandments as quoted from the scriptures of the living God. So this they say that the Freedom From Religion Foundation is a Wisconsin-based group that promotes separation of church and state and non-theism. Anyway, that's what Fox News says they are. I say they are a Wisconsin-based group that promotes the hatred of Jesus Christ and the destruction of the minds and souls of as many children as possible. That's what I say about the Freedom From Religion Foundation. And if they want to sue me, that would be fantastic. I would love to cross-examine the child-molesting perverts lawyers in the Freedom From Religion Foundation. I would love it. So there was a plaque in a middle school there, had the Ten Commandments on it. And let's see, what is this perv over at the Freedom From Religion Foundation? He says the plaque turns any non-Christian or non-believing student into an outsider. Yes, yes, he says school children already feel significant pressure to conform. They must not be subjected to similar pressure on religious questions. Pressure, the Ten Commandments. Huh. I would just ask him, like, okay, which one of the ten do you disagree with? I mean, I know the first one, you shall have no other God before me. I know you have a problem with that one. But of the other nine, which ones are bad for children? Anyway, but they don't want to talk about that. They're not really interested in a robust debate about the merits of the Ten Commandments. They just hate God, and anything that reminds them of God sends them into a frenzy. And their lawyers, to boot. So, do we have anything else? Let's see, the Freedom From Religion Foundation is celebrating the removal of the Ten Commandments from the Ohio Middle School. And a quote from the president, Annie Laurie Gaylor. She says, in America, we live under the First Amendment, not the Ten Commandments. That's what she said. All right, but here's the thing, Annie. So your life is like a vapor of smoke. It's here for a moment, and then it's gone. So you're a footnote in history, at best. All of us are. We're just a tiny little sliver of time in eternity, Annie. And eternity exists under the Ten Commandments, Annie, not under the First Amendment. So you enjoy your First Amendment now, okay? And you enjoy your limousine and your wine and your... She probably doesn't eat lobster. Anyway, you enjoy your vegan diet or whatever it is you do to impress your liberal friends. Annie, you enjoy that for now, because for eternity, it's going to be the Ten Commandments for you. All right. And if you don't repent, I'll be very happy as God rains down hellfire and damnation on your head forever for what you did to his children. All right, from there... From there, what do I want to do here? I want to talk about Betsy Ross flag. You want to talk about the... Here's the thing about the Betsy Ross flag. I always thought the Betsy Ross flag was the coolest looking flag. It was the best design. You know, like so many things. The first time, it's just that you can't really compete with that. The Betsy Ross flag is no doubt the best looking flag. The coolest looking flag. It's always been my favorite. Now, I don't have it on any knickknacks. I don't have it. Do I have it on a shirt? I don't have it on a shirt. And I'm not so sure I'm happy about the idea of putting the Betsy Ross flag on a shoe. And it may be just because of my military experience and what we were taught about the flag. You were never supposed to let the flag touch the ground. Right? So anyway, I'm just not so sure I'm happy with putting the Betsy Ross flag on a shoe. I mean, unless that shoe is going to be used for kicking Colin Kaepernick, then I might be okay with it. Now, when I was writing that bit, I was trying to think of funny places to kick Colin Kaepernick. And I was going to try to polish off that bit with a bodily area there where the kick would... But I just left it at that. I just want you people to use your imagination. Put the Betsy Ross flag on a shoe and visualize kicking Colin Kaepernick. Your host, Doug McBurney. I was waiting for another saxophone solo. So that's why I tried to have this conversation about a song back in the 90s. There was just a part of the song where it was just the drum, just like pop, pop, pop. And I was like, that's so awesome. And the guys in the shop were like, what are you talking about? I said, it's about the sound. It's not just about the arrangements and the melody and the harmony and blah, blah, blah. Sometimes it's just the sound. So that was a great sax drum. That was cool. That's all. All right. Now, we go from there to the Mark of the Beast file as we are rapidly running out of time here at the Weekly Worldview, as so often happens here at the end of the show. It's Mark of the Beast file. Yes, threats have been made against theater staff in Shuswap, British Columbia. A theater was planning to play the movie Unplanned, which takes a somewhat negative view of the killing of innocent children. It's been promoted as a pro-life, anti-abortion movie. And the pro-abort maniacs up in Canada, all the post-abortive women up there, which is probably a third or more of the population, is post-abortive, by the way, in North America. About a third of adult women and men. By the way, men are very much involved in the killing of innocent children. About a third of the people have killed their children. And they're maniacally defensive about anything that would even cast the shadow of an aspersion upon the fact that they killed their child. So they freak out, and they threaten violence against the theater chain. And so the board has confirmed that it's going to cancel the film's five-day run, which would have begun on July 12th, but it's not going to. Why? Because the people who are in the theater are afraid that someone might kill them or burn down their house or kill their children. And so they're not going to show the movie because they're scared. Because the tolerant, beautiful people have threatened to kill them or hurt them or burn them or something like that. And a very credible threats of violence. I mean, these people have already killed someone, for crying out loud. So I don't blame the theater owners for being legitimately frightened that they could be killed. These are killers. Now, let's go from there. Let's get to some actually interesting and good news from the Real Science file. This is fascinating stuff. The common cold virus could be used to cure cancer. Uh-huh. Yeah, 15 patients in a study were given an infusion of the common cold virus before undergoing surgery to remove and examine their cancerous tumors. And in every case, some cancer cells had been destroyed, and in one case, all traces of the disease had gone by injecting the tumor with the common cold virus. A researcher said the virus could become a universal agent to fight cancer. Yeah, So I guess this had to do with bladder cancer, which is there's about 10,000 diagnoses of bladder cancer in the United Kingdom annually where this research is taking place. Scientists say the treatment could be available in as little as 3 years. Most tumors in the bladder do not have immune cells, making the disease particularly hard to treat, reports the Telegraph. Infusion, a strain of the common cold virus called Coxsackie virus CVA21, was able to inflame the tumor. So they instigated inflammation in the tumor using the virus. And what does inflammation do? Well, it calls immune cells from around the body to rush in. And they rush right into the cancerous environment and they target the cancer cells. It's amazing. This is really interesting. Once the virus targeted the cancer, it replicated itself, making its effects even more powerful. Professor Hardev Panda, the principal investigator, he says, this comes as other trials examine the role of common cold viruses to treat a range of cancers, including breast, bowel, lung, and skin diseases. He says it's almost like a universal agent. Once it gets in, it kills the cancer. It could be combined with lots of other treatments. Amazing. Creationists have had this discussion. Why are there bacteria? Why are there viruses that hurt people? Well, in the original design, there's a pretty good chance that viruses did stuff like this. They did good stuff. Yeah, good stuff. And they're just like us, you know, they're fallen and broken and they're not working as they were originally designed. And so let's talk about a bacteria since we've given some good press to a virus. How often does a virus get good press? Not very often. But now let's give some bacteria some good press here. Listen to this from the Real Science File. Cancer immunotherapy using the body's immune defenses to fight cancer is transforming cancer treatment and has over the past decade, according to this is a report from the engineering department at Columbia University. But only a handful of solid tumors have responded to immunotherapy. The blood cancers have been more effectively targeted. Significant side effects also occur with immunotherapy. And so researchers want to design therapies that can induce anti-tumor immune response with a solid tumor without triggering systemic toxicity that has posed a significant challenge. So basically, our immune system has the power to kill anything, including us. And so when it's utilized and harnessed against things like cancer, quite often the side effects are the damage or the death of the patient. So targeting solid tumors has been significantly challenging. Well, researchers at Columbia have announced that they are addressing this challenge by engineering a strain of non-pathogenic bacteria that can colonize solid tumors in mice and safely deliver potent immunotherapies, acting like a Trojan horse that treats tumors from within. Now, this therapy led not only to complete tumor regression in a mouse model of lymphoma, but also significant control of distant, uninjected tumor lesions. And this research was published last week in Nature Medicine. So basically, the bacteria is used to deliver a nanobody that targets a protein called CD47. Listen to this. CD47 is a don't eat me signal that cancer uses to protect itself from immune cells. So it's like their, what was it on Star Trek? They had the cloak, the invisible cloak. That's what cancer does with CD47. It puts CD47 all around it so the immune system gets the signal, don't eat me. And then the cancer grows and grows and grows and it tricks the immune system. Well, they're targeting the CD47. The problem with targeting CD47 in the past has been that you can't stop the immune system from ignoring the signal throughout the whole body, and that can mean serious side effects. But the targeting of CD47 in the tumor itself without targeting CD47 throughout the system may be possible due to this Trojan horse delivery mechanism by using a bacteria. You see, CD47 is present elsewhere in the body, so the systemic targeting results in significant toxicity. To solve the issue, they've engineered bacteria to target the CD47 exclusively within the tumor, avoiding systemic side effects. bacterially induced local inflammation within the tumor, and the blockade of CD47 leads to enhanced activation and proliferation of T cells within the treated tumors. And without their invisible cloak, the cancer is exposed to the immune system and can be destroyed. It's pretty amazing. It is pretty amazing what is happening. And now let's go to one more from the Real Science file. Have we cured HIV? It's quite possible that we have. Using a combination of CRISPR gene editing and a therapeutic treatment called laser antiretroviral treatment, scientists at Temple University and the University of Nebraska said they have erased HIV DNA from the genomes of animals in an unprecedented study published last week in the journal Nature Communications. They said, CNBC reports, we think this study demonstrates HIV disease is a curable disease. The virus did not return in 9 of the 21 mice that were tested. And one of the researchers, do I have this fella's name? Gendelman? Well, I may not have copied the whole thing. Anyway, one of the researchers says, quote, we are at the cusp of a scientific revolution in human genomes that can change the course, quality, and longevity of life. So, ladies and gentlemen, if we can keep civilization from falling into the hands of the madmen, and we can continue to do science, I believe cancer will be cured in my children's lifetime. And, you know, I use that line a lot, that if we can stop civilization from falling into the hands of the madmen. And what's interesting about that is no matter where you're coming from, you agree with me on that. So I've had people look at me and I can tell they think I'm talking about Donald Trump. And I have others who obviously think I'm talking about Christian fundamentalists. And then I have others who think I'm talking about Islamic extremists. And then the really smart people know that I'm talking about the godless atheists who would bring us all down into the pit together. That's who I'm really talking about. And that covers a broad swath of everyone from, well, I'll just leave that aside. That's all. The founder of the Sundance Film Festival, this is from the Death Penalty file. Yes, the co-founder there has been sentenced now to six years in prison for the sexual abuse of a child. Why is this in the death penalty file? Because this guy should be getting the death penalty. When did we agree that you could hurt a child in this particular way and then live? I was not at that meeting. I did not get that memo. I would not accede to this in any way. The judge said he hopes the parole board will keep 72-year-old Sterling Van Wagenen in prison longer than the minimum, is what the judge says. What does that mean? Nothing. It's meaningless. Let's see here. This guy, Sterling Van Wagenen, has worked for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints on various projects, including videos for the big temple there. Now, one thing's interesting about this story. Van Wagenen thanked the man that originally accused him after his sentencing and said it was a blessing that he brought all this to light. So he said it to his accuser, it's a blessing that you brought all this to light. So that would be a wonderful thing if Mr. Van Wagenen was facing the death penalty, as he well should, because now there's going to be time for Van Wagenen in between this apparent, it looks like some repentance, right, in his heart here for what he did. But now there's going to be time between that and his death for him to harden his heart against God again. Whereas if we would have just killed this bastard about a day or two, three maybe, after his conviction, there wouldn't have been time for him to harden his heart again, and he might have had an opportunity to actually repent. So anyway, an opportunity missed there. Oh, by the way, who else? Wasn't there another big news on the, yes, what's his name? Jeffrey Epstein. You all remember Jeffrey Epstein, right? He's the guy who got away with molesting all those underage girls. Well, his case, now he's been arrested again in New York, and there's been a ruling that all the sealed documents related to his previous flim-flam shim-sham job that he pulled off with all the politicians he owned there in Florida and elsewhere. Well, his case now is about to reveal the scale of depravity among the American elite and among the global elite. So I remember a few years ago there was a story that circulated on the internet, and the crux of the story was that there was an underage child sex ring being run out of a pizza parlor somewhere back east. And so it turns out that that story wasn't ever factually confirmed. It's been debunked as something of an urban myth. But I've often wondered, why would rumors of something as wildly just insane as an underage child prostitution ring being run from a pizza shop, and that all the most famous and powerful people were involved, the Clintons and everybody, right? Why would that gain traction and have such currency among so many people? And I think it's because there's enough truth to it to be believable. And that this guy Epstein, his case is going to show us that something like that is happening amongst the elite. Something like the pizza shop, whatever they called that whole urban myth. Something like that is occurring amongst the elite. And this case could very well lift the curtain on a lot of very uncomfortable, embarrassing, and quite possibly criminal goings on amongst some of the most famous and powerful people in the world. Because, well, that's who Jeffrey Epstein ran with. He ran with Bubba Bill Jeff Clinton and other super powerful, mega rich politicians, elites from Hollywood, elites from governing officials from all over the world. They were all Jeffrey Epstein's friend. Donald Trump called him a terrific guy who loves beautiful women as much as I do. Although he likes them on the younger side. That's what Trump actually said about Jeffrey Epstein, who's about to be convicted of molesting who knows how many women. He could do 5 or 10 years in jail. He's molested so many underage girls. So Jeffrey Epstein, when he's convicted, of course, he should be put to death publicly and painfully, because none of us should be expected to tolerate men who hurt children in this way. I mean, that's just beyond the pale. There are some crimes that I can comprehend. I can understand why people do them. I can see the motivation. Some crimes I've been tempted to do myself. Some crimes I've actually perpetrated upon the world myself. Criminal acts. But there are some criminal acts that are beyond the pale and that shall not be tolerated. And the injury of children in this particular fashion must be exterminated with extreme, extreme prejudice. Publicly and painfully, Mr. Epstein. But he's not going to get the justice he deserves. But all of us might get to look and see just a glimpse of the scale of depravity among the American elite, and I think it's going to be shocking to all of us, the level of just sheer godless, evil depravity that is practiced on a regular basis without any conscience among the elite who govern us and who educate your children and who entertain you and your family and your children. I think we're all going to be shocked and stunned. And if it's not by the Jeffrey Epstein case, well, come and talk to me on Judgment Day, because it's all going to come out then. The things that were whispered in the darkness when nobody was looking will be shouted from the rooftops. And that'll be quite a day. You're going to want an advocate on that day. You're not going to want Jesus Christ to be your enemy. You will definitely want him to be your friend. So please look into what he has said and what he suggests you do. Because he does have a means by which you can find a way to live and to escape the fire that's coming. That's it for the Weekly Worldview. I'm your host, Doug McBurney. I want to thank my friends at KGOV.com and AmericanRightToLife.com. And of course, my other brother, Daryl, who makes it all happen here in the Weekly Worldview studio. Should the Lord tarry, we shall return next week. Until then, may the grace of God go with you, and may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.